Geekscape.com.
The Uprising by Colin Jordan. Part 3. Judging a Judge. The trial of a leader of a BFF unit seized in a raid on an army depot for weapons and ammunition began in Southampton in a court thickly ringed with armed guards because of the fear of an attempt at rescue. Merlin, the captured unit leader, had typically assigned himself the task of covering the withdrawal of his men with their booty, and he alone was captured when a hidden infrared alarm, the only one in the immediate vicinity of the entrance and exit route, undetected and thus not put out of action, was set off by a slight divergence on his part in his withdrawal. Guards, responding instantly, were able to surround and surprise and overpower him before he had a chance to detect them and elude them. Brought to court and placed amidst half a dozen guards, he refused to plead, refused to recognize the legitimacy of the jurisdiction and the authority of the judge, and in a demonstration of this, turned his back on the rest of the proceedings, having briefly made his verbal rejection of them very clear. This dramatic defiance aggravated the high blood pressure of the wigged dispenser of alien justice, who, in a crescendo of repetition, delivered amid an impressive shower of spittle, in vain ordered the implacable Merlin to turn and face him. He was therefore obliged to seek some consolation in devoting a summing up to the docile jury to a torrential denunciation of the BFF in general, and Merlin in particular, reaching an orgasm of gratification when, slowly pronouncing his words, with impassioned accentuation to prolong the pleasure, he imposed life imprisonment, without chance of remission, on the doughty fighter. This, in terms of the fiendish maltreatment of rebel prisoners, was, he full well knew, tantamount to a death sentence suspended but for a short time, to enable his captors to enjoy his punishment. The trial came to an end without intervention by the BFF, apart from the retort by Merlin to the pronouncement of sentence. Turning now to face his tormentor, he broke his silence with a resounding verdict of his own. Victory to the fighters for freedom, and death to the forces of tyranny. The guards, having then hustled him away to the prison van awaiting him, relaxed, joking among themselves at what they saw as cold feet of the BFF in the face of the show of strength by the guards. The prison van departed, conveying Merlin to his intended doom. The judge and court staff departed too, convinced that this was the end of the matter with Merlin, destined to disappear from sight and memory. But this was not to be. Some 5 miles along the way to the prison, the van had need to slow down to a crawl because of an obstructive car dawdling in front. Thereupon, while the car swung across the road and stopped just in front, a JCB digger, hired with false particulars, swung out of a farm track just behind and repeatedly rammed the rear door of the van until it broke open. Men from the unit, led by Merlin, leapt from the car in front, overpowered the crew of the prison van, released their leader, and with him drove off at speed after immobilizing the prison van and abandoning the digger. A short way ahead, on turning off onto a circuitous route of side roads, they stopped for just a couple of minutes to change the car's number plates. Some hours later, Judge Greenbaum retired early for the night in his luxurious home deep in the Hampshire countryside. Reposing cosily in his bed, he indulged in gloating contemplation of the distinctly less comfortable night confronting that awful person who had earlier that day defied and insulted him, but was now experiencing the penalty, beginning his amply deserved punishment, encompassing the rest of his miserable life. The thought of the fellow's outrageous impudence, however, even now caused him to splutter anew in still smouldering rage, despite all his ruminations on retribution. He was not to know that all too shortly he would have cause for more agitation over the fellow. He had been asleep barely a couple of hours when a severe slap on his face awoke him and brought him to see six men, portentously terrifying in their black hoods, surrounding his bed. One of them, who happened to be Merlin, commanded him to keep absolutely still and quiet during the court proceedings now to take place, or suffer instantaneous chastisement. Then, with this order being fearfully obeyed, Merlin proceeded, in a striking reversal of their roles of the past day, to present as prosecuting judge the indictment against Isaac Greenbaum. This was a damning record of his misdeeds in enforcing the tyranny's travesty of justice against patriotism. The recumbent accused, his bed now the dock, was then given an opportunity in this his trial for complicity in the structure of suppression to present his defence, an opportunity in which he displayed gross ineptitude and grovelling self-abasement. Sweating and stuttering profusely in his terror, he pleaded in whining tones and wheedling phrases for compassionate understanding and mercy. He had only been doing his job, he sobbed, and that in order to avoid disfavour and disgrace. He reached a near hysterical climax in a flood of apologies to the freedom fighters, begging to be forgiven and given a second chance. Merlin then conferred with his comrades, while Greenbaum gasped and gulped in his consternation. The verdict of the court was then announced to the quivering creature in the bed, probably the first time in British legal history that a verdict had been delivered to a prisoner in bed, and, moreover, who was supposed to be a judge. Greenbaum was told he had been convicted of complicity in the system of oppression, and sentenced to receive six lashes of a whip from each of the six freedom fighters present. A sobbing Greenbaum was then hauled out of the bedclothes, and with his back uppermost, held crosswise on top of them, with his pyjama trousers lowered, while the punishment was delivered, amidst howls of pain from the squirming Jew. At the end of the punishment, the judicial oppressor of patriots had been reduced to a heaving, moaning mass of flesh, his bare buttocks a mess of blood and wheels. The BFF men then left him, with a very clear warning indeed, that any further persecution of patriots by him would certainly result in his death, in distinctly unpleasant circumstances. In other words, Judge Greenbaum was placed on strict probation. Some safe time after their departure, newspapers received a communique from the BFF reporting the trial, conviction, and punishment of Judge Greenbaum following the release of Merlin from wrongful imprisonment. As James Murrow got out of his car that Thursday evening on his return from work, parking it outside the front door of his suburban home in readiness for a later trip to nearby friends for a meal, several figures detached themselves from the shadows of the trees and bushes in his front garden. His awaiting wife, taking a peep through the window on hearing the car's arrival, had just time enough to glimpse her husband being swiftly grabbed and bundled into another vehicle which had simultaneously entered the drive, pausing just inside it for just the few moments required to place temporarily obscuring covers on its number plates before drawing up to receive the captive Murrow and his captors and immediately go back down the drive. Again, pausing just for a few moments before emerging onto the road, this time for the removal of the covers on the number plates. The explanation of this drama in the drive, unknown to the wife at that particular time when she telephoned the police, who arrived too late to intercept the kidnapping vehicle there or elsewhere, was that her, James, head of the prison department of the Home Office, had been taken prisoner by a unit of the Freedom Force, intent on teaching him a well-deserved and unforgettable lesson of the painful prospects in store for those who maltreated captured members of that force. The course of correction lasted 3 weeks. At the end of it, a haggard and highly subdued head of the custodial branch of the hated Home Office, almost unrecognizable from the corpulent figure at the time he was taken from his car, was conveyed a sufficiently long, and thus deemed safe, distance away from his penal accommodation, and then dumped on the roadside, just outside a small town, and left to make his own way home to his wife, who was almost reconciled, never to seeing him again. But to go back to what preceded Murrow's release at the roadside, his course of treatment involved almost utter starvation, drastically weakening to both body and mind, vitality and will. This reduction took place in a windowless room of perpetual darkness in which he was confined, deprived of his watch, and without any means of knowing the passage of time, day into night, night into day, which is an excruciating disorientation. In this place of timeless blackness, he was left alone, with no company other than his distinctly disturbing thoughts and several toilet pails sufficient for his stay, at the end of which he would have to empty and clean them, and to and from which he had to grope his way very cautiously indeed. A metal plate, with only one piece of dry bread, and a metal mug, only of water, were at irregular intervals thrust through a very briefly opened small shutter in the door, after a whistle had been blown by the guard to alert the prisoner and require, first of all, the return of the plate and mug from the previous occasion. Apart from any noise Murrow himself made, or his jailer made, in bringing bread and water, utter silence accompanied the utter darkness. Anything he attempted to say to his jailer went totally unanswered, apart from half-ration at the next feeding time, which he had been told on arrival would be the punishment for talking, plus an extension of his imprisonment by 1 day per occasion. Murrow thus experienced the utmost isolation, the horrors of the void. 2 weeks of this deprivation of sight, sound, and nourishment were sufficiently debilitating and disorientating to affect markedly not only his former physical shape, but also his former state of mind, rendering him amenable to the formulation of a new self. Bereft of his arrogant conceit, by the sheer humiliation of his penal circumstances, and beset, interminably, with gruesome fantasies of fear, germinating in a mind put out of balance by the prolonged darkness and silence, Murrow had become frantically desperate for the sight and sound of another person, whoever it might be. So eager had he become to escape the agony of his limbo that he was prepared to welcome frantically the mere presence, the mere voice of some other person, and with that to embrace any and all requirements imposed upon him by that saviour from exclusion and isolation. This meant that he had reached a state wherein he had become highly susceptible to the eradication of past beliefs and the implantation of new ones by a controller. It was then that a saviour in the form of a controller did appear, to the rapturous gratitude of James Murrow. This was a member of the unit which had seized and imprisoned him, a member who had elected to specialise in applied psychology, and who, within the remaining week of Murrow's custody, brought the man, now so anxious to ingratiate himself, to recognise with fervent repulsion the wickedness of his past treatment of imprisoned patriots, and to experience an overwhelming urge to avoid and prevent this in the future. Indeed, on the day of his release, by way of being dumped on the roadside, as already related, the former oppressor of imprisoned freedom fighters, now most abjectly repentant, sought to kiss the hand of his controller in an overflow of thanks for his regeneration. For some 6 months thereafter, reborn Mr. Murrow successfully but slyly undermined the prison service's persecution of captured freedom fighters by piecemeal measures of amelioration before his palliatives became too noticeable and objectionable to his superiors, and the Home Secretary decided he had to go by way of early retirement because of his apparent decline into softness. The minister never came to know of his subordinate's mind-moulding treatment during his capture, making him virtually a new person. All that this new person ever told people on his return from the 3-week absence was that he had suffered days of chastisement and deprivation for his role in the regime. The benefit, temporarily derived from the brainwashing of James Murrow, was much added to by steps taken around the same time to make it personally known to many prison service personnel by communication, stating name and address and some other personal facts of identity and daily life, that they were under close watch and that maltreatment of BFF prisoners would most certainly result in severe punishment, in one form or another, to them and their families. Those pinpointed in this way were thus placed on probation as prisoners of prescribed conduct. Conference in session. Do not disturb, read the card on the handle of the editor's room in the seething innards of the Daily Dispatch. The editor, Julius Silva, was an imperious character whose commands were not to be contravened. Thus, the bustling minions of his staff left the room strictly unvisited. The paper was the main outlet in London for the views and requirements of the government of alien occupation and control, then in power in the country. Inside the sequestered editor's room sat an unusually silent and spasmodically trembling Silver. Near to him were four men who appeared to be in charge of the situation. One of them waved in Silver's direction from time to time, as if to lend emphasis to points in his denunciation of the editor which he was delivering, an object consisting of a pliable stem which had at one end a bulb of rubber filled with lead shot and which was commonly known as a cosh. This moving object Silver surveyed with visible apprehension. On his desk there now lay a pile of copies of the paper for the day previous, which Silver had been required to telephone for to be left outside the door, and which one of his visitors had then brought in after a pause for the messenger to go away. This happened to be an issue containing a particularly vicious editorial penned by our Julius himself, attacking the BFF as a band of depraved terrorists devoted to damaging the new system of racial harmony, the superlative merits of which he described. Before long, one by one, the four men attending Silver slipped separately from the room. At the first unobserved opportunity on leaving the building, they removed items of simple disguise before merging with a crowd of pedestrians in the street and departing the area. The commandment on the card on the editor's door, not to be disturbed, remained obeyed for about an hour afterwards before the news editor, getting no answer when telephoning for some urgent guidance, plucked up the courage to knock on the door, to do so several times more on receiving no response, and eventually to open it. The sight which met his eyes was truly amazing. Silver lay on the floor, his arms and legs securely bound, his mouth sealed with surgical tape. On his desk were strewn copies of the previous day's issue with its editorial removed. pinned to Silver's jacket was a notice declaring that as a fitting punishment for his foul editorial, its author had been obliged, literally, to eat his words. In fact, as Silver subsequently disclosed, he had been obliged, under the duress of the waving cosh, to take into his mouth and chew and digest no less than 50 copies of his editorial. Rushed to hospital, in abdominal agony from his unaccustomed repast, Silver more or less recovered physically in about a week. He never fully recovered mentally from his experience, and after a short spell back at his desk, in the room of his punishment, he